20. Auger hailed a taxi on Boulevard Saint-Germain. By then she had exchanged her ripped and soot-smeared coat for a hip-length black jacket, with a matching hat tilted low to disguise her grubby face and hair. She would not bear up to close inspection, but in the twilight of late afternoon the transformation was adequate. "Gare du Nord," she told the driver, before showing him the paperwork she would need to cross the river. "As quick as you can, please." The driver grumbled something about not being a miracle worker, but before very long they had crossed the river and were herring through the narrow back streets of the Marais, dodging the thickening flows of Saturday traffic. Auger felt an absolute exhaustion looming over her like a crumbling precipice, ready to fall and crush her at any moment. She leaned her cheek against the rattling window of the taxi, and through blurred eyes she watched the lights of shops, neon signs, and cars slide by in hyphens of red, white, frigid blue, and gold. The city looked as untouchable and unreal as a hologram, as fragile as the glass she was resting against. She was very tempted to think of it that way. None of it mattered, she told herself. Nothing that happened here could have any consequence for her life back in Tanglewood. There was no need to continue with the investigation Susan White had started, for nothing that came out of that investigation could possibly affect Auger's existence back home. Even if something terrible did happen here, and she could not quite shake the feeling that something terrible was indeed going to occur, then it would be no more tragic than the burning of a book, or, in the worst case, a library of books. E2 might be lost, but a month ago she had not even known of its existence. Everything and everyone she really knew would continue unaffected, and within a few months the ordinary grind of her life, with its ebb and flow of routine, pressures, and crises, would have reduced these memories to a thin, dreamlike paste. And it was not as if everything from E2 would be lost forever if something bad happened, for much had undoubtedly already been learned from the documents that had been smuggled back to antiquities. And though she would feel some sympathy for the people trapped in E2, the trick was to remember that they were not really people at all, but the discarded shadows of lives that had already been lived 300 years ago. Feeling sorry for them would be like feeling sorry for the images in a burning photograph. Auger felt her resolve collapsing by the minute. She did not want to get on the overnight train to Berlin, not when there was the much simpler option of staying in Paris and waiting for the ship to return. She had been sent here to do a job, and she had done it to the best of her ability. No one could possibly blame her if she stopped now, and thought only of her own preservation. The taxi slowed and pulled up in the station forecourt, its engine still running while the driver waited for payment. For a moment, Auger could not move, frozen in a lull of indecision. She thought about asking the driver to turn around and take her to another hotel somewhere else in the city, where Floyd and the others would not think to look for her. Or she could follow through with her plan, go into the station and catch the train to Berlin, thereby heading deeper into Europe and deeper into E2. Just the thought of taking the train made a lump rise in her throat, as if she was being asked to step close to the edge of something high up that made her dizzy. She had not been trained for such a mission. Caliscan had primed her, barely, to recover the paperwork, but not to go deeper into E2. Surely there were other people who were bound to be better qualified for it than her. The thought that this might be true stung her like a lash. "You can do this," she said to herself, repeating it like a prayer. The driver turned around in his seat to face her, the hairs on his neck bristling against the collar of his shirt. He didn't care how long she took. The meter was still running. "Here," Auger said, thrusting some notes at him. "Keep the change." A minute later, she was inside the iron and glass vault of the station, looking for the ticket office. The platform swarmed with travellers, jostling and orbiting each other like a mass of grey bees, each knowing their mission and utterly oblivious to anyone else. Beyond, the trains waited with snorting impatience, pushing quills of white steam up towards the roof. Even as she watched, a sleeper drew out, headed for Munich or Vienna or some other city even further into the European night. Its red taillight spilled blood onto the polished surface of the rails. First things first, Auger found the ticket office and was relieved to see that the line for international connections was much shorter than the others. She had already vowed that if there was no accommodation left on the night train, then she would simply board it and argue her case later. Bribery was always an option, as was theft, but there were still couchettes available on the 7 o'clock service, later than she would have liked, but better than nothing. She handed over the money, the ticket clerk barely batting an eyelid at her blackened hands and dirt-encrusted fingernails. She imagined that the clerks had learned not to bat their eyelids at many things. "What platform?" she asked. The clerk told her, also warning her that the train would not be ready for boarding until 30 minutes before departure. That gave her nearly an hour before she could get on the train. She used the first 20 minutes of that period finding a ladies' washroom and attending as best she could to the dirt and damage she had sustained in the tunnel. By the time she was done, she had turned the bar of carbolic soap black and the basin looked as if it had been used by a party of miners after a shift down the pit. But she looked and felt human again, and by the time she had changed into more of Greta's clothes, stuffing her own soiled and ripped garments back into the bag, she had also begun to feel that she was less likely to be recognized. With over an hour remaining before the train was due to depart, Olga was tempted to leave the station entirely to seek the comparative anonymity of a local bistro or brasserie. She had not eaten since breakfast, and her hunger was beginning to catch up with her. But she knew that if she left Gare du Nord, she might not have the courage to return, no matter how much money she had spent on the couchette. Instead, she settled on a restaurant inside the station, and within its mirrored labyrinth of an interior, she found a secluded booth where she could watch whoever came and went without being the object of attention herself. She ordered a sandwich and a glass of wine, and willed the hands of the restaurant clock to whirl around to 6:30. Through the glass doors of the restaurant, far across the concourse, she saw a man in a grey raincoat and hat pause at a newspaper concession. As he fiddled in a pocket for change, he looked around, like a tourist taking in the station for the first time. After making his purchase, he turned from the concession stand, pushing owlish glasses back up his nose. He flicked open the paper and started reading. It wasn't Floyd. Olga's food arrived. She sniffed the wine, drank half the glass down in short order, and for the first time since waking that day permitted a temporary calm to flow through her. In a little while she would be on the overnight train, safe in her berth. It was no more dangerous than staying in Paris, less so, perhaps, since she would be putting increasing distance between herself and the war babies. Once in Berlin, she would follow up on the address for the Berlin manufacturing firm and see where that led. At no point would she put herself in harm's way, or do anything she felt might expose her true identity. Even if all she came back with was a description of the firm's premises, she would have achieved something useful. Caliscan would undoubtedly rebuke her for exceeding the terms of her mission while expressing private gratitude for what she had done. And even as she followed up Susan White's aborted line of inquiry, Olga would be observing more of this world than she ever could if she stayed locked up in a Paris hotel room, cowering from every shadow. Another man in a raincoat pushed open the doors to the restaurant. He was hatless, but for a moment, as the steam from the coffee machine blocked her view, it could also have been Floyd. But the man had no sooner stepped inside than a slender woman in a body-hugging emerald dress stood up from her table, and the two of them kissed like the illicit lovers Olga was sure they were. The man had a gift for the woman, which she opened with a gasp of nervous delight. It was some kind of jewelry. He ordered a drink, and the two of them sat there holding hands for 10 minutes, whereupon the man kissed her goodbye and vanished back into the bustle of the station. A minute later, Olga heard the whistle of a departing train, and knew with absolute certainty that the man was on it, heading back to his provincial house and his provincial family, that 10-minute assignation as much a routine as brushing his teeth and kissing his wife goodbye each morning. For a dizzying instant, the people around her suddenly felt as real as anyone she had ever known, and it was only by a supreme effort of will that she was able to reduce their lives once again to something more manageable, like an echo or afterimage. Olga checked her watch. In a few minutes she would be able to board the train and find her couchette. An hour from now she would be halfway to the French border, and by the time she awoke she would, for better or worse, have arrived in Berlin. She signalled for her bill, then began gathering her things. Perhaps it was the wine, but now she felt a steely resolve to complete the investigation Susan White had begun. A waiter in a white cummerbund brought the bill. Olga dug through her coinage, satisfied when she found enough to include a reasonable tip. Smiling, she slid the money towards the waiter and made ready to leave, deciding she would be better off not finishing the wine. It was then that she saw the children. There were two of them, standing quite still next to each other in the middle of the concourse. The boy held the lank thread of a yo-yo, while the girl carried a toy animal that looked as if it had been rescued from a dustbin. The boy wore a red t-shirt and shorts, with white socks and buckled black shoes, the girl a dirty yellow dress and the same kind of shoes. It was only when one really looked at them that it became clear that they were not really children at all, but ghouls in the rough shape of children. The rain had distorted their makeup, making it sag and run. Travelers pushed around them, but gave the children a certain distance, perhaps without realizing it. Orga lost sight of the diminutive figures as a group of people blocked her view. She swallowed and tried to keep her nerve. Her imagination might be running ahead of her. They might just have been street urchins after all. When the group dispersed, the two children were gone. She closed her eyes in relief, then quickly finished what remained of the wine. She told herself to get up and leave the restaurant while the train was still waiting. There was no point reacting in horror every time a child walked by. Paris was full of strange little boys and girls, and they were not all out to kill her. A couple of businessmen moved away from the front of the restaurant. There were the children again, standing perfectly still, but now much closer to the door. They were not looking at her, but they were regarding something or someone with the unblinking attention of snakes. Another group of passers-by obstructed her view, and when they had moved away, the children were even closer, their attention clearly directed at the restaurant itself. A moment ago she might have stood a chance of leaving without them noticing her, but now she was trapped. Orga looked down at the remains of her sandwich, then pretended to read the menu again. The last thing she wanted to be seen to be doing was taking an unusual interest in what was going on outside. The children might not necessarily know exactly what she looked like anymore, after all. When she risked another glance towards the door, only the little girl was standing outside. The boy was now inside the restaurant, waiting by the illuminated counter where freshly made cakes were laid out for inspection. A pair of flies hovered near the boy, seemingly more interested in him than in the sugary delicacies. Orga sank down into the booth. She had a clear line of sight to the boy, but he did not appear to have noticed her yet. Staying rooted to the same spot of floor, his head was rotating in a slow and level arc, like a tracking surveillance camera. She was tempted to move behind the cover of another of the mirrored screens separating the booths, but knew that the boy would probably notice. His eyes blinked, but rarely, as if he had to remind himself each time. In a few seconds, he would be looking directly at her unless she moved. Belatedly, she remembered that she was carrying two weapons, the automatic and the sleek gun that she had taken from the war baby in the tunnel. The knowledge gave her a flicker of confidence, but she soon dismissed any thought of using the guns. The children were probably armed themselves, and there might be more of them than the two she had noticed. Besides, even if she dealt with the children, she would stand little chance of leaving this busy station without being apprehended and arrested. The boy's gaze had almost speared her. Frozen, she knew that her only hope lay in his failing to recognize her. Perhaps he would not, given her state of dishevelment and the fact that she was wearing someone else's clothes. She had no sooner clutched at this straw than she forced herself to dismiss it, for the boy was obviously looking for her specifically, and would not be fooled by a few superficial changes. Orga's hand reached under the table for the automatic. Perhaps she would have to use it after all, regardless of the consequences. The boy looked at, or more exactly, through her. She felt as if a searchlight beam had swept over her. The smooth rotation of his head continued, taking his attention beyond her. His head had turned through nearly 90 degrees from the starting position of its arc, and showed every indication of continuing, impossible though such a movement would be for a human child. Orga wondered how long it would be before someone else spotted the peculiar little boy, but as far as she could tell, the other people in the restaurant had noticed nothing out of the ordinary. Then the child's head stopped and reversed, until the boy was looking towards her again. This time she felt the focus of his attention. He wasn't just looking in her direction, but was concentrating on the booth in which she was sitting. A barely recognizable change came across the powdered and smudged mask of his face, the tiniest widening of his mouth suggesting a smile of triumph or gluttony. The boy's head snapped back towards the restaurant door, and he opened his mouth to emit a single shriek. To any casual bystander, it would have sounded like a meaningless, yodel-like exclamation, evidence perhaps of idiocy on the child's part, but Orga knew that the shriek was crammed with sonic information and that the other child was fully capable of deciphering it. Stiff-kneed, like a puppet that wasn't being worked properly, the boy began to walk towards Orga's booth. She tried not to react in any way, keeping her own attention on the clock, hoping that the boy would have second thoughts before he reached her. He had pocketed the yo-yo, and now something gleamed in his hand, mirror bright and sharp as glass. A hand touched the boy's shoulder. The boy yanked his head towards the adult in fury and incomprehension, his face twisted into a scowl that served only to crack and dislodge the remaining scabs of makeup, covering up his true appearance. The hand emerged from the dark sleeve of a suit belonging to one of the waiters. The man was large enough amongst adults and towered above the boy. Still trying not to look directly at what was happening, Orga saw the man crease himself down the middle to bring his mustached, fat-necked head into proximity with the boy. The man started to say something, his lips working silently across the room, and then there was a quick flash of silver, and the waiter stepped back from the boy with a look of mild surprise on his face, as if the child had sworn at him in an ingenious and adult way. The man crashed back into the display of cakes, sprawling across the zinc-topped surface. In the pure white of his cummerbund was a little spreading star of red where he had been stabbed. The man dabbed at the wound with his fingers and lifted their reddened tips to his face. He started to say something, the words jamming in his throat. Around him, some of the other diners dropped their cutlery and started talking in alarmed voices. A man shouted something, and a woman screamed. A glass went crashing to the floor. The boy had gone. Within a few seconds, complete pandemonium had erupted around the stabbed waiter. Orga could see only the backs of do-gooders crowding around him. Another waiter yelled into the restaurant telephone, while a third jogged across the concourse to fetch help. The scene had already begun to attract the attention of onlookers outside, waiting for trains. Some kind of railway official, a remarkably similar-looking individual to the man Floyd had bribed that afternoon, began to stroll towards the door and, seeing the size of the commotion, broke into a wheezing, heavy-bellied lope. Someone blew three sharp blasts on a whistle. Orga stood up, gathering her things. Were the children still out there waiting for her? There was no way of telling. What she did know was that she did not want to be here when, as seemed certain, the police arrived and began taking the names and addresses of witnesses. She could not afford to miss that Berlin train, and she certainly could not afford to fall into the machinery of the law. What if the station official at Cardinal Lemoine had decided to talk to his superiors after all? She wiped crumbs from her lips and judged her moment, excusing herself past the concerned onlookers crowding around the wounded man. She might as well have been made of smoke for all the attention anyone paid her. Pausing at the door, she looked left and right along the concourse, but there was no sign of the two children. All she could hope was that they had decided to leave the station before too many witnesses described a vicious little boy with a knife. As quickly as she could, without attracting unwanted attention, Orga made her way to the departures board and double-checked the platform for the overnight train to Berlin. It was waiting now, a long chain of dark green carriages with a black steam engine simmering at the far end. Along the length of the train, the station staff were still preparing it. There were trolleys loaded with linen, food and drink, and men in uniforms were coming and going through the open doors, barking to each other in heavily accented French. A station official shook his head at Orga as she tried to step onto the platform, tapping his watch with a finger. "Please, monsieur," Orga said. In the distance she heard the scraping whine of police sirens nearing the railway station. "I need to be on that train." It might have been the worst thing she could have said if the man got it into his head that she was running from the authorities. "Mademoiselle," he said apologetically, "5 more minutes, then you can board." Orga dropped her bags and dug into what was left of her money. "Take this," she said, offering him 10 francs. "It's a bribe." The man pursed his lips, looking her over. The siren sounded very near now. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw people still cramming around the entrance to the restaurant. 20, he said. "Then you can find your couchette." "For 20, you can help me find it," Orga replied archly. The man seemed to find this an acceptable compromise, pocketing the additional 10-franc note and leading her down the length of 2 carriages until he found one that corresponded to the number on her ticket. Inside, everything was clean, bright, and narrow. The man found her compartment and pushed open the door. There was a key on the inside of the door, which he removed and gave to Auger. "Thank you," she said. The man inclined his head, then left her alone. There were two bunks in the sleeping compartment, but she had paid to have the entire cabin to herself. There was a neat, aluminized basin and tap in one corner, plus a tiny cupboard and a small fold-down writing desk and stool. The walls were varnished wood with recessed electric lights. There was a communication cord and pulled-down fabric blind, and a faded monochrome photograph of some cathedral she didn't recognize. Auger slid the window down, letting in the noises of the station. Amidst the clatter of slamming doors, arriving and departing trains, and announcements over the tannoy, it was difficult to be sure, but she did not think she could hear the sirens now. Did that mean the police had passed the station by entirely on some other errand? She looked at her watch again, willing the hands to slide around to departure time. From somewhere nearby, outside the train, she heard a heated exchange of voices. Slowly, Auger inched her head out of the window so that she could look back along the length of the train. There was the man she had bribed, gesticulating and arguing with a pair of uniformed policemen. Angrily, they pushed past the man and began strolling along the line of carriages. They were walking very slowly, stopping at each compartment window. One of the men had a ribbed metal flashlight, which he was shining into each compartment, tapping on the glass at the same time. The station official trailed behind him, muttering under his breath. Auger forced herself to breathe again. Slowly, slowly, she moved her head back inside and slid the window up to its closed position. There was time to get out of the compartment, but what if another policeman was moving along the inside of the train, covering that line of escape? The voices of the two officers came closer. She heard them tapping on the glass two or three compartments down from hers. It was much louder now. There was barely time to move her things out of sight, and certainly no time to think of hiding herself. All she could do was act as naturally as possible. Auger dragged the blind down halfway and sat, waiting. There was a knock on the interior door. She held her breath, silently willing whoever it was to go away. The person knocked again. A low, urgent voice whispered, "Auger!" It was Floyd. It was Floyd, and she really did not need this. Keeping her own voice low, she pressed her lips to the door. "Go away. I said I didn't want to see you again. And I think we have unfinished business. In your imagination, perhaps. Let me in. There's something I have to tell you. Something I think might make you change your mind. Nothing you could say or do, Wendell." But she silenced herself. The officers outside were now very close to her compartment. "I kept something back," Floyd said. "What do you mean?" she hissed. "From that box of papers. Figured it might be useful to have some bargaining strength. I got everything I needed from those papers already, Floyd. Is that why you're on your way to Germany? Because you already have all the answers?" "Don't overestimate yourself," Auger said. "What happened back at the restaurant?" She saw no harm in telling him. "One of those child things. It stabbed a waiter." "The kid was looking for you?" What was the point of lying now? "Give yourself a pat on the back. Now quit while you're ahead and leave me alone. The policemen outside think you might have had something to do with it. You fled the scene, after all. Innocent witnesses don't do that. Ask Custine. He'll tell you all about it." "I'm sorry about Custine," she said. "I'm sorry he got involved in all of this, and I hope you can find a way to help him. But it isn't my problem. Your entire little world isn't my problem." "You know what really hurts? The way you almost sound as if you mean that." "I do mean it," she said fiercely. "Now go away." "Those policemen aren't going to let you ride this train anywhere." She heard the whistle and snort of a departing train, but it wasn't the one she was sitting in. "I'll deal with them." "Like you dealt with me this afternoon? You weren't going to use that gun, Verity. I could see it in your eyes."
"Then you're an exceptionally poor judge of character. I would have used it if necessary."
"But you wouldn't have enjoyed it." There was a hard knock on the glass. A voice with a Parisian accent said sharply, "Open the window." She slid the blind up and pulled on the leather strap that lowered the glass.
"Do you want to see my ticket?"
"Just your identification," said one of the officers standing outside.
"Here." Auger slid the papers through the gap in the window. "Is something the matter? I wasn't expecting to have my papers examined until later."
"Is there anyone else in that compartment with you?"
I think I'd have noticed.
I heard you talking.
With a casualness that surprised her, Olga said, I was reciting a list of the things I have to do in Berlin. The man made an equivocal noise.
You're on the train alone before anyone else. Why were you in such a hurry to get aboard?
Because I'm tired, and I don't want to have to squabble with anyone else over who has the ticket for this compartment. The man reflected on this before saying,
We're looking for a child. Have you seen any unsupervised children hanging around?
Just then, another voice distracted the man. It was Floyd, outside now. He spoke in soft, urgent French too fast for her to follow, what with all the background noise of the station, but she recognized child and a few other significant words. The other man responded with further questions, skeptical in tone at first, but with increasing urgency. He and Floyd exchanged a few more heated words, and then she heard footsteps heading with some haste away from the carriage. A few seconds later, she heard the shrill, repeated warble of a police whistle. Moments passed, then Floyd knocked on the door to her compartment again. Let me in. I just got those goons off your back. And you have my undying gratitude, but you still have to get off this train. Why are you so interested in Berlin? Why are you so interested in the Kaspar contract? The less you ask me, Floyd, the easier time of it we'll both have. The contract is for something unpleasant, isn't it? Something you want to stop happening. Why do you assume I'm not actually trying to help it happen? Because you have a nice face. Because the moment you walked into my office, I decided I liked you. Well, like I said, you're not necessarily the best judge of character.
I have a ticket for Berlin, he said. I also know a good hotel on the Kurfürstendamm.
Well, isn't that convenient?
You have nothing to lose by taking me along for the ride.
And nothing to gain.
Silver rain, Floyd said.
It was said in such an offhand way that at first she thought she had simply misheard him. That was the only logical explanation. He couldn't possibly have said what she thought he had. Could he? She dropped her voice even lower.
What?
I said silver rain. I was wondering if it meant anything to you. She flicked her eyes to the ceiling and opened the door to the corridor. Floyd was standing there, hat in his hand, looking at her with puppy dog eyes. What you just said, she began.
It means something to you, doesn't it? He persisted.
Shut the door behind you. A whistle sounded, and a moment later the train lurched as it began to crawl out of the station. Floyd took out the postcard he had kept back. He passed it to Auger and let her examine it. She switched on the reading light and held it up for closer inspection. The train rattled and bounced, gathering speed as it negotiated the maze of interconnecting tracks beyond the ends of the platforms. It's significant, isn't it? He prompted. The postcard was a message from Susan White to Caliscan. Clearly, it had never been sent. Equally clearly, it had something to do with Silver Rain. But Silver Rain was a weapon from the past, a thing of wonder and terror, like a biblical plague. Silver Rain was the worst thing that could happen to a world. More than that, it was quite possibly the last thing that would ever happen to a world.
21. The train slipped through monotonous moonlit lowlands, somewhere east of the German border. Every now and then, the lit oasis of a farmhouse or a cozy little hamlet slid by in the night, but for long stretches of time they passed through endless dark fields, as lifeless and unwelcoming as the space between stars. Occasionally Auger glimpsed a fox, frozen in mid-step, or the swooping passage of an owl skimming low across a field on some solitary vigil. The animals were drained of color by the moonlight, pale as ghosts. These little pockets of life, welcome as they were, served only to emphasize the vast lifelessness of the territory itself. Yet the rhythmic sound of the train's wheels, the gentle rocking motion of the carriage, the distant muted roar of the engine, the warmth of a good meal and a welcome drink inside her, all these things lulled Auger into a kind of ease, one that she knew was transient and not especially justifiable, but for which she was nonetheless grateful.
So tell me, Floyd said, how are we going to play the sleeping arrangements?
What would you suggest?
I can sleep on the seat I booked. Floyd's expenses hadn't stretched to a couchette ticket.
You can use the lower bunk, she said magnanimously, dabbing a napkin at the corner of her mouth. It doesn't mean we're married, or even particularly good friends.
You sure know how to make a guy feel appreciated.
I mean, Wendell, that this is purely business, which doesn't mean that I'm not glad to have you in the vicinity, in case they show up again. The children. She nodded meekly. I'm worried they'll have followed us. Not on this train, Floyd said. They'd be too conspicuous, even more so than in the city. I hope you're right. Anyway, it isn't just the children. They had just finished dining in the restaurant car in the company of a dozen other travelers, most of them better dressed. Almost all of the other diners had now retired to the adjoining bar car or their individual cabins, leaving Auger and Floyd nearly alone. A youngish German couple were arguing over wedding plans in one corner, while a pair of plump Belgian businessmen swapped tales of financial impropriety over fat cigars and cognac in another. Neither of these parties was the least bit interested in a low, intimate conversation between a couple of English-speaking foreigners. What else, then? Floyd asked. What you said. What you showed me on that postcard. Yes. Well, it dashes any hope I might have had that I was actually imagining all this. You weren't imagining those children. I know, Auger said. She sipped at the remains of her drink, knowing that she was a bit drunk and not caring. Right now, a little fogginess of mind was exactly what the doctor ordered. But the reference on that postcard to Silver Rain, well, it means that things are about 10 times as bad as I thought they were. Maybe it would help if you told me what this Silver Rain is all about, Floyd suggested. I can't tell you that. But it's bad, isn't it? When I dropped those two little words into your lap, you looked as if someone had walked over your grave. I was hoping that my reaction hadn't been so obvious. It was written in sky-high neon. Those two words were the last thing you wanted to hear. Or expected to hear, she said. Coming from my lips. From anyone's lips. You shouldn't have held back that postcard, Wendell. It was thoroughly dishonest. And you pretending to be Susan White's sister, that's what you call setting an appropriate example, is it? That's different. It was a necessary deception. So was mine, Verity. Then I suppose we're even. Can we leave it at that? Not until I know what those two little words mean. As I said, I can't tell you. If I had to put money on it, Floyd said, I'd say it was the code name for a secret weapon. Question is, who's on the trigger? The people behind you and White, or the people who killed White and Blanchard and sent those children to stalk you? It isn't our weapon, she said fiercely. Why do you think Susan White was murdered in the first place? So it's their weapon, not yours. That's enough, Wendell. I'll take that as a yes. Take it any way you like. It doesn't make any difference to me. Let me join the dots here, Floyd said. Susan White stumbles onto a conspiracy. The Caspar contract in Berlin is part of it. So is Silver Rain, whatever that is. I guess all these things are connected somehow. Although right now I don't see how those metal spheres can be any part of a weapon. The spheres aren't the weapon, she said icily. I don't know what they are, except that they must be involved in all this somehow. And if I knew that, I wouldn't be sitting on this train being pestered by you. But you do know what Silver Rain is, don't you? Yes, she said. I know exactly what it is. I saw what it can do with my own eyes only a few days ago. Where was that? Looking down on Mars from a spaceship. Where else? Cute. How about the real answer? The real answer is that it's a weapon. It can kill a lot of people in one go. More than you would want to believe possible. Thousands? Try again. Hundreds of thousands? Better. Millions? Warm. Start thinking entire planetary populations, and you're getting close. Then it's some kind of bomb. Like the big firecracker the Americans say they'll build one of these days. An atom bomb. She almost laughed at the quaintness of it, but checked herself in time. In the mid-20th century of her own timeline, there had been nothing quaint about it, any more than siege towers and boiling oil had been quaint in the 13th. No, it's not an atom bomb. An atom bomb would be bad, I grant you that, but whether you drop it from a plane or load it inside a missile, a bomb's a weapon with a specific focus of attack, a city or a town. Bad news if you're there when it drops, equally bad news if you live in the fallout zone. But for everyone else, business carries on more or less as usual. Floyd stared at her with a kind of horrified fascination. And Silver Rain. Silver Rain is much worse. Silver Rain touches everyone. There's no escape, nowhere to run, no way to protect yourself, even if you know it's coming. There's no way to negotiate with it or buy your way out. She paused, knowing that she had to tell him enough to satisfy his curiosity, but must not even hint at the truth. Already she regretted the little Mars wisecrack she had made earlier. Things like that could get her into serious trouble. It's like a plague, spreading through the air. You breathe it in and you feel fine. It doesn't hurt you, and then one day you just die of it. Horribly, but quickly. Like some kind of mustard gas.
Yes, she said, just like that.
You said it can kill millions of people.
Yes.
Who would use such a weapon? Wouldn't they be just as likely to die at the same time? If they didn't take the necessary precautions, she said, then yes, they might.
And these precautions?
Too many questions, Wendell. I'm just getting started. He changed tack. The Caspar contract. Could those spheres be a cover for something else? Such as this silver rain you won't talk about. Could the factory in Berlin be making this stuff?
No, she said, shaking her head. Silver rain isn't like that. It isn't something you make with foundries and lathes.
A chemical, then? If there's a foundry, there's probably a chemical works nearby.
It isn't something you make in a chemical plant either.
A small, quiet voice at the back of her head whispered, "Careful." But she pressed on regardless. Silver rain is a special kind of weapon. It requires a very specialized manufacturing capability, one that just doesn't exist in Germany or France. Or anywhere else on this planet, she added to herself. Floyd swirled around the remains of his drink. So who is making the stuff?
That's the point. I don't know.
But you seem so familiar with it. It can be made, she said, just not locally, which means you'd need to import it and then find a means of deploying it. She thought of the sensor, with its automatic blockading of all forms of nanotechnology. Unless there was some as yet undiscovered means of bypassing the sensor, there was no way to bring something like Silver Rain into E2. The trick Skarsgård had pulled with the pneumatic drill, dismantling it into simple, solid components and smuggling it through in pieces, wouldn't work either. The only way to break nanotechnology down into smaller pieces and put it back together again later was with more nanotechnology. The rhythm of the train, the wheels clicking across the joints in the rails, seemed to goad her thoughts onward, like a whip. While it was true that the indigenous technology on E2 was nowhere near advanced enough to manufacture something like Silver Rain, and wouldn't be for at least a century, there was always the possibility that Slasher agents had established a covert research and development program somewhere. Orga thought about this for a moment and then dismissed it. No amount of advanced knowledge could compensate for an industrial technology still stuck in the steam age. Silver Rain was incredibly complex, even in terms of the nanotechnology available in Orga's timeline. But you couldn't even make the simplest item of nanotechnology here on E2. You couldn't even use the available tools to construct the specialized equipment necessary for manufacturing even the least sophisticated nanotechnological components. Given time, the necessary technical base could have been achieved, but not without some or all of that magical technology leaking into the world and thereby changing it. The Caspar contract, on the other hand, looked more like the kind of covert program that might actually work. Whatever function those spheres served, they had been manufactured using indigenous technology and know-how. Which made the reference to Silver Rain all the more anomalous. Someone planned to use it, that was clear. But they couldn't make it within E2, and they couldn't smuggle it through the sensor. So they must have found another way of delivering it. If you couldn't enter the house by the front door, she mused, you found another way in. You broke a window. Another portal? Perhaps such a thing existed, but there was a high probability that it would also come with its own sensor. Which left the one possibility so horrifically obvious that she'd overlooked it completely. If they could find their way to the outside of the ALS, and if they had a means of cracking that shell, then they could simply deliver the Silver Rain directly, spraying it into the atmosphere from space. But that couldn't be possible, surely. No one knew where the ALS was situated. The duration of the hyperweb transits was only weakly correlated with distance in actual light years, and there was no indicator of a direction at all. Auger's thoughts returned to the house analogy. The hyperweb was like a vast meandering underground tunnel system that emerged here and there in the basements of isolated old mansions. But there were many, many mansions strewn across the landscape, and no way of telling from the inside which one a particular tunnel had emerged in.
The windows were bricked up, the doors barred, and the skylights boarded over. If only you could rip away some of those barriers, then perhaps you might get a glimpse of the surrounding landscape and have some chance of identifying the house into which the tunnel led. Could the shell be cracked from the inside somehow?
Verity, Floyd said gently, is there something you'd like to share with me?
I've shared more than enough.
Not from where I'm sitting.
He leaned back into the plush upholstery of his seat, studying her in a way that made her feel both uncomfortable and perhaps a little flattered. He wasn't a bad-looking man, really. A bit crumpled around the edges, perhaps, and in need of a wash and a comb. But she'd known worse.
I'm sorry, Wendell, but I've told you all I can.
You don't even have all the answers yet, do you?
No, she said, glad to be able to say something in complete honesty for once. All I have are the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle Susan White left me, which may or may not be sufficient to reconstruct the answer. If they are, I'm just too stupid to see it.
Or maybe the answer isn't that obvious.
That's what I keep wondering. All I know is that she must have been closer to the truth than I am right now.
And look what good it did her, Floyd said.
Yes, Auger replied, saluting Susan's memory with a lift of her glass. But at least she died trying.
Auger found herself alone on the Champs-Élysées, moving along one broad tree-lined pavement amidst the surging flow of the crowd. She remembered being on the train with Floyd, but that particular investigation had led nowhere. When they had arrived in Berlin, they had found it covered with ice, inhabited only by bickering tribes of feral machines. The trip had been a waste of time. How could she ever have forgotten that crucial detail? Now she was back in Paris, alone and a little sad despite the vivacious mood of the other pedestrians. It was the middle of the morning and everyone was already overloaded with shopping and groceries and bright bouquets of flowers. Everywhere she looked, there was riotous colour, from the clothes and belongings of the Parisians to the overflowing shop window displays and the trees, which were hung with gem-like fruits. Cars and buses sped by in blurs of gleaming chrome and gold. Even the horses shone, as if suffused with some soft inner light. Above the bobbing heads of the pedestrians, the Arc de Triomphe rose over everything, pennanted in a thousand pastel colours. Auger had no idea why she was walking towards it, or what she would do when she arrived. It was simply enough to be swept along by the other walkers, carried on their tide. All around her, couples and gatherings of friends laughed and made plans for later in the day. She felt their gaiety begin to elevate her mood. Behind her, she heard a steady rhythmic sound. She looked over her shoulder, through gaps between the people immediately behind her, and saw a child, a small boy, walking a dozen or so paces to her rear. The boy was the only other solitary person on the street, and as he walked, with a methodical clockwork slowness, the other people made room for him, moving aside as if by some kind of magnetic repulsion. The little boy was wearing a red t-shirt and shorts, and white socks and buckled black shoes, and she knew that she had seen him somewhere before, not long ago. He had carried a yo-yo then, she remembered, but now a toy drum hung around his neck, upon which he was rapping out the insistent rhythm that had first drawn her attention. The tattoo he beat out was like a complicated heartbeat. It never varied, never slowed or quickened. The little boy unnerved her, so she pushed forward with the flow of pedestrians. Gradually the drumming sound faded away. When she could hear it no more, she risked a glance behind her and saw only a thick mass of shoppers and promenaders, with no sign of the little drummer boy. She kept walking briskly, and when she looked back again a little later, there was still no sign of him. But the mood of the avenue had changed. It wasn't the boy. She was certain that none of the other Parisians were properly aware of him, but the weather. The colours on the street were suddenly muted and drab, and the flags on the Arc de Triomphe fluttered like old grey rags. The sky, an untrammelled blue a moment earlier, now seethed with coal-black rain clouds. Sensing the imminent downpour, people dashed for the shelter of shop awnings and metro entrances. Up and down the Champs-Élysées, umbrellas formed the choppy sea of bobbing black. It started raining in dribs and drabs at first, darkening the pavement with a mottled pattern, but quickening until it was sluicing down in hard lines like drawn glass, spraying off the umbrellas, gushing from drain pipes. People who were still outside renewed their efforts to find shelter, but there were too many of them and not enough places to run to.
Cars and buses threw showers of water onto the scurrying crowds. People dropped their belongings, abandoning them to the elements as they continued their frantic search for cover. The wind picked up and flipped their umbrellas over, lifting them into the sky. Auger, who had stopped, looked around at their expressions, watching the rain chisel fury into their faces. But she felt none of it. The rain was warm and sweet, and it had the fragrance of expensive perfume. She lifted her face to the sky and let it anoint her, drinking it in. It was delicious, warm where it touched her skin, exquisitely cool as it slid down her throat. Around her, the people kept running, slipping and sliding on the wet paving stones. Why couldn't they just stop and savor the rain? She wondered. What was wrong with them? Then the texture of the rain changed. It began to prickle her skin and eyes. It began to sting her throat. She closed her mouth, still holding her face to the sky, but no longer gulping it down. The prickling intensified. The rain, gin clear a moment ago, was now steely and opaque, coming down in chromed lines. Rivers of mercury poured from the drains and flooded the gutters, turning the pavements into mirrors. No one could stand up now, only Auger. Everyone else was flailing around, thrashing on the ground as they tried to struggle to their feet again. The rain flowed across their faces, puddling in their eyes and mouths as if trying to find its way inside. A horse, separated from its delivery cart, thrashed ineffectually in the street, struggling to stand until its legs snapped like sticks. At last even Auger turned her face from the sky. She held out a hand and watched the reflective shafts ram through the gaps between her fingers. The clouds began to disperse. The downpour abated and blue sky began to push through again. The rain gradually slowed to a trickle and then stopped. The mirrored pavements began to dry as the sun crept out again. Cautiously, the fallen people picked themselves up. Even the horse somehow regained its footing. "It's over," she heard people say, relieved, all around her, as they resumed their progress along the avenue. No one seemed concerned that they had lost their belongings, only that the silver rain had ended. The street bloomed with colours once again. "It's not over," Auger shouted, the only person standing still as the pedestrians surged around her. "It's not over." But no one paid her any attention. Even when she cupped her hands and cried out even louder, "It isn't over. This is only the beginning." The people walked past her, oblivious. She reached out and grabbed a young couple, but they wrestled free of her, laughing in her face. With a dreadful sense of inevitability, she watched them continue their progress towards the Arc de Triomphe. After a dozen steps, they faltered and stopped in mid-stride. At exactly the same instant, so did everyone else on the street. For a moment, the Champs-Élysées was perfectly still, thousands of people suddenly completely motionless, some in the most ludicrous of postures. Then, very slowly, as one, they lost their balance and toppled to the ground. Their perfectly immobile bodies littered the sides of the avenue as far as the eye could see. Even beyond the Champs-Élysées, a palpable stillness had descended over the entire city. Nothing moved. Nothing breathed. The bodies had become silvery grey, drained of colour. All was quiet. It was, in a way, quite beautiful. A city finally freed of its human burden. Then a breeze picked up, blowing along the length of the avenue. Where it touched the bodies, it lifted coils of shining dust from them, twining them through the air like long, glittering scarves. As the dust peeled away from the bodies, it removed first their clothes and then their flesh, revealing chrome bones and steel-grey armatures of nerve and sinew. The breeze strengthened, abrading even the bones, smoothing the bodies into odd abstract curves, like a landscape of intertwined sand dunes. Coils of dust snaked between Auger's lips, peppery and metallic. She was screaming now, but it was pointless. The silver rain had come and no one had heeded her warnings. If only they had listened. But what good, she wondered, would it have done them anyway? She heard, distantly, a rhythmic sound. Far off in the sea of blurred skeletal remains, a single figure remained standing. The little drummer boy was still drumming, still walking very slowly towards her, picking his way between the bones. "Verity," Floyd said softly, "wake up. You're having a nightmare." It took her several seconds to surface through the dream, even with Floyd shaking her gently. He stood next to her bunk, his head level with hers as she opened her eyes to the dimly lit railway cabin.
I thought I was back in Paris, she said. I thought the rain had begun.
You were screaming your head off.
They wouldn't listen to me. They thought it was over. They thought they were safe.
She was cold, drenched in her own sweat.
It's all right now, he said. You're safe. It was just a nightmare. Just a bad dream.
Through the gap in the curtain, she could see the moonlit landscape slipping by outside. They were still on their way to Berlin, still on their way to that ice-bound, machine-stalked city, as dangerous in its way as the excavated bowl of Paris. For a moment she panicked, wanting to tell Floyd that they had to turn around, that this was a futile journey. But gradually her thoughts rearranged themselves as the dream began to fade a little. They were headed to a different Berlin, one that had never known a nanocaust or any of the other horrors of the void century. That brightly lit, rain-soaked Paris had been a dream.
They wouldn't listen, she said softly.
It was just a nightmare, Floyd repeated. You're safe now.
No,
she said, still feeling as if the dream might reclaim her at any moment, still seeing the drummer boy stepping towards her through the maze of bones, as if that part of the dream was still playing somewhere in her skull, moving with clockwork deliberation towards an inevitable conclusion.
You're safe.
I'm not, she said, nor are you, nor is anyone. We have to stop it from happening, Wendell. We have to stop the rain. His hand closed around hers. Gradually she stopped shaking and lay there numbly, and for a little while she let him hold her hand, until she fell back into an uneasy sleep, drifting bodiless through the dust-strewn streets of an empty city, like the last ghost in town. They arrived in Berlin by mid-morning on Sunday. All around the city, party banners and flags were on display again. Now that Rommel and von Stauffenberg were both safely in the ground, the bright young things had decided that it was time to give National Socialism another crack of the whip. The advertising men had come up with some careful changes. The old hard-edged swastika was gone, replaced by a rounded, softer successor. The party big shots still gave rallies in the Zeppelin field, but they saved their best performances for the tiny, flickering window of television. Now there was a little slice of Nuremberg in every well-appointed living room, every beer hall and railway station cafeteria. There was talk of parole for the big fish languishing in the Gare d'Orsay. Perhaps even some kind of triumphant return to the Reichstag in the evening of his chemically sustained days.
It shouldn't be like this, Auger said quietly.
Amen to that, Floyd replied under his breath.
It was a short taxi ride to the Hotel Am Zoo, a good place at the fashionable end of the Kurfürstendamm, decked out with high-class marble and chrome so clean and polished that you could eat your dinner off it. At least the hotel hadn't changed much. Floyd knew it well enough, since he and Greta had stayed there on two or three occasions in the early 50s. Given that familiarity, it had seemed like the obvious place to head for. But once Floyd had checked in and carried their very few belongings up to the single room they'd just paid for, he began to feel the onset of an annoying but familiar sense of guilt. It was as if he was consciously cheating on Greta, visiting this old romantic haunt of theirs with another woman. But that was absurd on two counts, he told himself. Greta and he were no longer an item, even if the door to them being an item again in the future hadn't been completely closed. And Auger and him, well, that was just ridiculous. Why had the thought even entered his mind? They were here to work on an investigative matter, strictly business. So what if you liked her? She was nice-looking and clever and quick-witted and interesting. How could a lady spy be anything but interesting, he thought. But any other man would have said the same thing. Liking her did not take great strength of character. You didn't have to see past superficial flaws. There weren't any, except maybe the way she kept treating him like somebody who not only didn't need to hear the truth, but who couldn't handle the truth. That part he didn't like, but it only made her more fascinating to him, a puzzle that had to be unravelled, or unwrapped, perhaps, depending on the circumstances. When she had finally fallen back to sleep after her nightmare, Floyd had lain awake on the lower bunk, listening to her breathing, thinking of her under the sheets, and wondering what she was dreaming about now. He wasn't crazy about her, but she was the kind of girl he could very easily allow himself to become crazy about, if he wanted to. But none of that meant anything. She must have walked through life with men like him falling at her feet,
squashing them underfoot like autumn leaves. It probably happened so often that all she noticed was that nice, crunching sound. What would a girl like Verity Auger want with a washed-up Joe like him? He was Wendell Floyd, a jazz musician who didn't play, a detective who didn't detect. If he hadn't kept back that postcard, she wouldn't even have let him join her on the train. In which case, maybe she wasn't so dumb after all.
"Wendell," she said.
"What?"
"You seem preoccupied."
He realized that he had been standing at the window, moping there for at least 5 minutes. Across the Kurfürstendamm, a group of workers were bolting together a tall, pressed steel monument to the first ascent of Everest. The young Russian airman was depicted standing astride the summit, raising his gloved fist in what was either a cheery salute to an overflying aircraft or impish defiance at a vanquished and obsolete god.
"Just thinking about old times," he said.
"When you were here before?"
"Guess so."
"I'm sorry if I've made things awkward between you and..." She paused to jot down a telephone number, using a pad letterheaded with the name of the hotel.
"Greta," he said, before she had a chance to say the name.
"And no, you haven't. I'm sure she knows the score." Auger looked up, her finger poised halfway down one page. She was sucking on a strand of hair, as if it helped her to concentrate.
"Which is?"
"That you and I are here on business. That you didn't even want me along for the ride. That there's nothing more to it than that. She's not jealous, is she?"
"Jealous? Why should she be?"
"Exactly. No reason in the world.
We're just two adults with some mutual interests in Berlin,
saving money by sharing a single room."
"Precisely."
Floyd smiled. "Now that we've got that out of the way."
"Yes.
What a relief." She looked down at the telephone directory again, wetting a finger to turn one of the tissue-thin business pages.
"I should have found a different hotel," Floyd said.
"What?"
"Nothing."
He turned back to the bed, his attention lingering on the shape of Auger's calves under those stockings. They weren't the longest legs he'd seen on a woman, or the shapeliest, but they were some way from being the worst.
"Floyd?"
She noticed him staring, and he snapped his gaze up to her face, a little embarrassed by the direction his thoughts had been taking.
"Did you get anywhere with that telephone number?"
he asked. She had used the telephone several times while he had been looking out of the window, but he hadn't been paying attention to the outcome. A certain amount of talking had been involved whenever she placed a call, since they all had to be relayed through the hotel switchboard, but his rudimentary German made listening in a pointless exercise.
"No luck so far," she said.
"I already tried this number from Paris, but figured there might be a problem with the international connections."
"I tried it as well," Floyd said. "It didn't work for me either. The operator said it was as if the line had been cut off. How could a big firm like that not have paid their bill, or not have anyone to answer their telephone? Haven't they heard of answering machines?"
Auger called through again. She spoke very good German each time, or at least what sounded like very good German to his ears.
"Nope," she said. "Line's totally dead. It isn't even ringing at the other end."
She smoothed the hand over the letter from Caspar Metals, uncreasing it.
"Maybe this number's wrong."
"Why would they print the wrong number on the letterhead?"
"I don't know," Auger said. "Maybe they changed the number but still had a lot of the old paper lying around. Maybe the man who sent this used old stock he'd had lying in his desk for years."
"Sloppy," Floyd said.
"But not a crime.
Did you check the directory as well?"
"It lists the same number," she said, "but the directory looks old. I don't know where to go from here. We have an address on the letter, but it's just a generic post office box address for correspondence to the whole steelworks. It's not specific enough to be useful. It doesn't even tell us exactly where the factory is."
"Wait," Floyd said. "Maybe we can bypass Caspar Metals entirely. Just get in touch with the man who sent that letter and see what he has to say."
"Herr G. Altfeld," Auger said, reading from the paper. "But Altfeld could live anywhere. He might not even be in the telephone directory."
"But maybe he is. Why don't we check?"
Auger found the Berlin area private number directory and passed the heavy dog-eared book to Floyd.
"Here we are," Floyd said, leafing through it. "Altfeld, Altfeld, Altfeld, a lot of Altfelds. There's got to be at least 30 of them, but not many with the first initial G."
"We don't know for sure whether that G refers to his first name," she observed.
It'll do for now. If we don't hit the jackpot, we'll move on to all the other Altfalts.
That'll take forever.
It's elementary drudge work, the kind that puts a roof over my head. Pass me a pen, will you? I'll start making a list of the likely candidates, and see if you can rustle up some coffee. I think it's going to be a long morning.